My name's Roger Hudson. I've been a volunteer with Results for about 32 years. And I want to thank you all for coming to hear about microcredit and its utility as a tool to help people alleviate their own poverty. Last time you heard a speaker on that subject was when John Hatch, founder of the Foundation for International Community Assistance, was here a few years ago. John was is a microcredit movement colleague of Alex's of long standing. I've been a kind of an observer of Alex's career since he was an earnest and energetic young college student at Cornell University quite a few years ago. He came to the microcredit field through Results, which is the organization that I'm involved with, which is a grassroots citizens lobby on poverty issues. As an undergrad at Cornell, he was a volunteer activist with Results and then an intern in the Results office. And it was really through Results that he came to learn about microcredit and to end up dedicating his life to the advancement of that concept and the worth that it could bring to people around the planet. After he'd been got out of college, he got a Fulbright scholarship and moved to Bangladesh, which is the cradle of the microcredit movement. And then he returned after a year and took a job with Results in our DC office, where he became the legislative director. And I got to kind of be exposed to him each month when we have national monthly conference calls discussing legislative issues and what it would take to create the political will to end hunger. And then each year, many of the Results volunteers travel to DC where we attend an annual conference and then go up on Capitol Hill and lobby our congressmen and senators. And I remember during this period when Alex was employee of Results as legislative director that it was a particular subject of intense interest, his love life, because he was a very earnest, shy young man. And many Results volunteers took an active interest in matchmaking for him. I'm happy to report that we succeeded in helping him achieve a very fine match. He's been happily married for going on 20 years now. After his stint at Results, he returned to Bangladesh and spent almost 5 years there, primarily working with Muhammad Yunus, founder of the Grameen Bank. The Grameen Bank and Yunus together shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. And in fact, Yunus is one of only seven people that have ever achieved the trifecta of winning the United States Presidential Medal of Freedom, the U.S. Congressional Gold Medal, which Results was very active in helping him receive, and the Nobel Peace Prize. So he's a pretty eminent person on the planet. And just as a slight aside, one of the things Alex is going to do during his brief visit to Alaska is speak again at a Results fundraising reception this evening at 6 o'clock at Aladdin's at Tudor and Old Seward. And there's a flyer by the door you could pick up if you think you might be interested in attending that event. And the winner of our drawing, Pat Kennish, who's also a supporter of Results, doesn't know this, but I'm going to ask her to receive anybody who wants to let us know for sure that they're interested in attending tonight. If they could let Pat know, then we could have a better head count for ordering the refreshments and so on. There'll be wine and appetizers at Aladdin's. I'm sure most of you have eaten there. It's a great place. After Alex had been in Bangladesh for a while, he, along with Muhammad Yunus, John Hatch, Sam Daly Harris, the founder of Results, and a number of other sort of pioneers of the microcredit movement, conceived of a microcredit summit, which was convened in 1997. And at that time, just 17 years ago, only about 8 million households were having access to small loans for self-employment to help them lift themselves out of poverty. But the Microcredit Summit that Results helped organize in 1997 adopted the audacious goal of reaching 100 million of the world's poorest families with credit and other financial services by the year 2010. I'm happy to report, although we were a year late, that target was achieved, which represented a huge expansion of the microcredit movement and the services and benefits it's delivered to the poorest people on the planet. After the 1997 summit, it came to Alex that he wanted to found his own organization in the United States, and a few weeks later, he founded the Grameen Foundation in the United States. He's been the leader of it ever since. It's been extremely successful. One other thing I should mention about his accomplishments is when he was first spent time in Bangladesh, he wrote a book about UNIS and the Grameen Bank and microcredit in the United States as well, which was called Give Us Credit. It was very well received, and then after UNIS won the Nobel Peace Prize, he did a second book called Small Loans, Big Dreams, also very well received, and it brings up to date, as of that time, the success of the microcredit movement. And without any further ado, I give you Alex.
So this is my rebuttal to dragging people through my love life in my 20s. So this is what you can become if you are earnest and energetic, and that's the message or something like that. I'm so happy that you're here, that you've taken yourself indoors on a beautiful Alaska day to hear what I have to say. And I want to, I'm very pleased that you've invited me. But I also say that, you know, there's so many things that can take up our time, great things like family, like whatever, advancing our political beliefs, being in our places of worship, our hobbies, our family, our friends. And yet, I think to go throughout life without a real fluency in global affairs, as we engage in all those things, to be blissfully unaware of what's happening in the world is a really dangerous idea in today's world. And so I really want to salute all of you, and I'm very pleased to hear that your membership has increased. People trying to engage in these issues, learn about them, and then apply them in all the other domains of their life. So I'm really honored to be invited to be part of that. I'm not going to be particularly give you a kind of a long advertisement about Grameen Foundation. We're a 17-year-old foundation set up to advance the work of the Grameen organizations in Bangladesh that are been going on much longer. We're focused on financial services and information technology as poverty alleviation accelerators. And if you want to learn more about what we actually do day to day, my colleague Carrie Hammett-Kester is right here. Hammett-Kester, just raise your hand, and we'll be happy to talk to you after. She's flown up from Seattle. But the basic thing I'd like to put before you is one of the least known stories in global affairs of the last 25 years is that there was a goal set to cut the number of absolute poor in the world by half by the year 2015. And that goal is going to be met. Right? It's not going to be met in every country. But because some countries exceeded that goal significantly, in the aggregate, that goal will be met. Yet no one's talking about that. And yet and why I think it's so important is when I first started thinking about poverty when I was at Cornell in the 80s, what I thought was that poverty was not only its own problem, but it contributed to many other global problems, overpopulation, diseases, infectious diseases, war, civil unrest, and so forth and so on. And so to have cut that in half in 25 years, right on schedule, is an amazing accomplishment. And I think some will say, well, India and China experienced a lot of economic growth, and that was the reason. Yeah, that was a big contributor. But there were hundreds of grassroots efforts, some of them reaching significant scale, that in the aggregate, I think we're at least as important as the growth in those two big countries, and in fact contributed, especially in India, to that growth and that shared growth. And I, lest you think that it's all on autopilot now, going from 1 billion poor to close to zero in the next 15 years is going to take an all-out effort. It is going to take us learning from and leveraging what we've done to this achievement that we have now. And what I think's happened, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, is we've started to think about poverty differently. And that thinking has led us to act in a more effective way. And the basic, if I had to tell you the basic idea how we think differently, is for years, decades, centuries, we designed how we thought and interacted with the poor based on an analysis of their deficiencies, usually an exaggerated idea. What we actually are beginning to do is to actually look at poor people and relate to them through their strengths, through their capabilities, in some areas much more capable than we are. Just to give you one example, if researchers have stopped, in several cities in the US have stopped people coming out of grocery stores and asked them what the things in their grocery bag cost. And across the board, the poor were able to tell much more accurately what the things in their shopping bag cost. And not a little bit, a lot, right? Their intelligence, but their intelligence is focused on survival, on getting through the day and getting the most out of that dollar, because they don't have very many. And so then you start to think about the entrepreneurial nature, especially of the poor in developing countries where there's no social safety net, where if you don't work for yourself, you're probably going to starve. In fact, just surviving is a demonstration of capability. And so let me tell you just a little story that always sticks in my mind trying to underscore this point. Professor Muhammad Yunus, 2 decades after he started doing the micro-lending, giving people a loan for a small business in Bangladesh, he started a phone company, a mobile phone company with a European partner. And many parts to that story, but he said one of the conditions was he wanted to set up one Grameen woman borrower in every village with a mobile phone, not for her own use, she probably had never even made a phone call in her life, but to become the payphone for the village. So people would line up at her door and want to make a call or receive a call. So people thought that this was way beyond the capabilities of the women, to learn how to use a phone without supervision, without people there to help her. So he said, well, if that's the case, the loans we give for the phones, we'll forgive them, but let's try. So a year after they gave out the first phones in this one part of Bangladesh, he went back and he asked, called together a bunch of women and said, he asked them, he said, how many months did it take you to feel comfortable placing a call or receiving a call on your phone, basically? And the woman kind of looked up at him strangely and said, Professor Yunus, to ask me that question, you must own a very complicated phone. He's a national figure, but he's just, because Professor Yunus, I don't know about your phone, my phone, it only has 10 numbers. So I saw this as a way to earn money for my children, put them into college, put food on the table. It took me about 1 minute to learn each number. So I was in business in 10, I don't know about this month's thing. So the next woman, not to be outdone, says, Professor Yunus, I realized after 8 months that I'd memorized the country code of every country in the world. Third grade education. A third woman, still not to be outdone by those two, said, Professor Yunus, if you give me the name of a country and a working phone number in that country, I'll dial it for you, blindfolded. And if I don't get it on the first ring, my phone is yours, because I think you need one of these new simple phones. So people have capabilities. You give them a chance, right? So let me tell you a little bit about my own story. I was at Cornell in the 80s. A bunch of my fellow classmates wanted to bring to the attention of everyone of apartheid South Africa. And they built a big shanty town. It was kind of Occupy Cornell, way before what happened a couple of years ago. And it just, all of us, we had to walk to class. And there was so much student belief in this that the administration didn't rip down the shanty town until after the semester was over. And so all of us thought, what, are we relevant to this global poverty question? And so I said, you know, if I'm going to be involved in poverty, I don't want to be about stopping the things that are bad in the world around poverty. I want to be around supporting the things that are good. So what is good? Who's got some poverty strategy? And then I started hearing more and more about Muhammad Yunus. So then I was one night over the great fuel of college students, pizza and beer. I said, my gosh. I mean, not really, no. I mean, not no. Pizza and apple juice. And so I said, what if this guy, Muhammad Yunus's work, could be spread around the world? We would defeat poverty. So I had the Alex Counts solution plan for defeat of global poverty. So I welled up my courage, and I sent a letter to Muhammad Yunus saying I wanted to finish my studies and go work with him and implement my plan for eliminating global poverty. He wrote me back. It wasn't the internet. It took 6 weeks. And he invited me to join, the first foreigner to ever really settle in with Grameen. And so when I arrived there about a year later, he sent me out to the villages. He wanted me to share all of the lives of the poor. I shared their diseases. I've had malaria, typhoid, you name it, I've had it. I learned their language. I let them say in their own words what their experience of getting a loan of $100 was like, that they could invest in a small business, put some better food on the table, reinvest in the business. And I saw the power of it. It didn't always work. Sometimes it worked in very small ways, sometimes in very dramatic ways. And then I was reading more and more research was coming out, and a major research just came out a few weeks ago on Grameen that was covered in The Economist, if you look it up if you want to see it. And so it was saying that microfinance was really moving the dial on poverty. And in fact, I wish someone would do this research. If you look at the countries that are doing very well with respect to that goal of cutting poverty in half by 2015, most of them have very vibrant microfinance sectors and financial inclusion. So I kind of saw all this happening. And one way to think about the microfinance story is that basically it wasn't that just they were putting little branches of banks throughout rural Bangladesh, because Bangladesh had banks in even the smallest little cities and towns and villages since the 1960s. Reaching the last mile to deliver a useful service to the poor isn't basically about physical infrastructure or even putting people there. It's about designing products that are around the capabilities and the deficiencies and the needs of a certain population. And so Grameen would set up these little branches right next to the normal bank branches, but because everything they did was, how do we create value? How do we develop a financial product that will actually activate the potential of a poor woman? And they didn't get it right first. They had to iterate and tinker for years and years and years, but they built up a vibrant bank serving 8 million poor women that is profitable, not as an earner a big profit, does it on a commercial basis. And again, the research shows has really helped many of those women get on a path out of poverty. Now, results in the microcredit summit did something very important in 1997, Roger mentioned it, which is call together, ask the UN to first convene a session to take microfinance global, to have it be as much present in every poor country as it was in Bangladesh. And by a certain year, 2005. And the UN said, quantifiable goals, timeline, not being set by our bureaucrats, no way. So results and a few other people said, well, forget the UN, forget governments, let's just do it ourselves. We'll hold a big meeting and we'll ask anyone who believes in this goal, come, and then develop their own action plan for reaching the goal. It was one of the great civil society, people-led social movements in history, I think. And the goal was ultimately met a year late through a huge effort. And so that created, for many of us at Grameen, we were saying, what are we going to do to contribute to this goal? Right up to that point, Grameen was just in Bangladesh, had trained a few people elsewhere. And so that's when Muhammad Yunus said, Alex, why don't you go off to Washington, see if you can raise some money and see if you can get some people involved in supporting it globally. And he gave me startup capital for an organization in the U.S., $6,000. Fortunately, in retrospect, I was too naive to know that that wasn't really a lot of money to start an organization with. But you get there, you take one step, you take the next step, you grow an organization. And so we started to think, what can we do to help advance this? So a couple of years into it, we raised $1 million with a guy named Steve Rockefeller at my side in 3 weeks to help some microlending programs in India grow. And it was a big success, and we set the goal of raising another $1 million the next year, but the next year was 2001. So I was having a lot bigger, tougher time raising money. And I sent two businessmen off to India to look at how we would deploy the next $1 million, which was given to grassroots programs who would then, you know, make that $100 loans. And so on the day after Easter 2001, one of the businessmen called me from his hotel room and said, Alex, I've had a great insight about how we're going to advance microfinance in India. The money's all here. And I said, good, Jim, because it's not here. So basically what he did is he said that the mainstream banks are sitting on a lot of money, a lot of deposits, and if we could just incent them to kind of wholesale that money to the grassroots microlenders and give them a little bit of a loan guarantee, a partial guarantee, that we could solve the problem of how you finance the growth of India. And so that year we put down $250,000 as a loan guarantee and got several commercial banks to lend $10 for every $1 of our guarantee, $2.6 million. And that, India then went on to become the most vibrant microfinance sector in the world. Then a couple years ago had some problems, and like any sector that has rapid growth, is now on another sustainable path. But what we did is we developed that into a loan guarantee program globally that basically with $31 million of guarantees backstopped by some of our wealthy board members has leveraged $250 million in microloans over the last 10 years without a single default, knock on wood. And we're actually winding it down next year because now banks, it's very common for banks to lend directly to microlenders who then take that money and distribute it as small loans to poor families. So, and this got us out of the thing where microlenders, either they could get money through donations, perhaps through a platform like Kiva, maybe if they were profitable from an international lending organization, but most of them couldn't get money. And then more recently, we've been moving to have them develop micro savings programs. So now, poor women, when they have a surplus in their business, can put money into an account. They might or might not tell their husband about it. Oftentimes, it's a better idea that they don't. Build up a surplus for their business, for an emergency, and then that money then can be the money that's lent to the poor women who want to take loans. So it's a totally self-sufficient system. Now, looking ahead, in terms of what's on the future horizon now, past 2015, I'll say that the what's exciting, this infrastructure to give microloans has been built out globally. I mean, you can go through places, very remote places in Uganda, where I've been recently, Morocco, you name it, and you'll see the signboards of three or four different microlenders in a small outlying town, competing for the business of poor women and the occasional poor man in that community. But now what we're trying to do is, having built that out, we haven't really put as much effort as we should have into developing very customized, flexible loan products. A lot of times, and part of it is to make the audit process easier, almost all the loans in a given organization were for the same duration, a similar amount. If you paid it back, you could get a little bigger loan the next year. Now we're in this amazing thing using technology and using the principles of human-centered design to say, if you're a woman and you want to do a business for this, let's work the loan and the structure of the loan to match your cash flow so it fits snugly and helps you, and that's going to help people get out of poverty much faster. And let's put in a savings program. Maybe it's like a commitment savings program where you save the same amount every month, and insurance, work insurance into it. So more diversity of financial services and more customized financial services. And one of the things we've been doing in Grameen Foundation is trying to leverage the digital revolution, because in an increasing number of countries, people are able to actually transfer money from their one cell phone to another cell phone. And cell phones in East Africa cost $10 or $12, these cheap Chinese phones. And the whole infrastructure is being done. It began with people sharing minutes with each other on their phone, but then it became really you could share true currency. In fact, a quarter of the GDP of Kenya now travels through mobile phones. So we've actually made an investment in an organization called Musoni that is the first cashless microfinance institution in the world. Every loan and every payment is made phone to phone. So all the risk and all the hassle of carrying big wads of cash and to villages to give out, to collect, all the potential for fraud and inefficiency and all of that, makes the accounting for it much, much easier. So that's one of the frontier activities. And then I'll just close by saying that we think that not only financial services can be a great enabler, a great catalyst for the poor, but so can information, right? Information that really delivered in a way that changes behavior. You know, here we are in the United States, and diet books fly off the shelves of bookstores, and yet it doesn't seem to be changing the behavior of the average American. But there are certain ways to deliver information that really do change. And we've been focused on how the information revolution can be an enabler. And so I'll take you the story about that as it began in Uganda, where we took that village phone program that I mentioned earlier through that story, we took it to Uganda. We had our learnings and had our setbacks early on, but we ultimately developed it into an 80,000 member village phone operator network throughout Uganda, very successful. Sold our part of that company back to the phone company and used that money to start something in Rwanda. And ultimately what we found was that business, as the phone companies, partly because of our success, saw that there was a market for telephone services in the remote rural areas, pretty soon everyone got their own phone. So we said, where do we take this? We have these 80,000 women who are at the cutting edge of technology. And so we said, well, there's a huge amount of information that is useful to them in their roles as subsistence farmers and also in terms of taking charge of their own health care. But that information never reaches them in time. What if we were to create ways to put that information online, essentially, in a way that they could access through a very basic mobile phone? And I won't go through the technical details, but you could just send an SMS, ask it a question, and it would, with 90% accuracy, understand the question, send you back an answer. Well, we did that. We were so proud of ourselves, but it changed knowledge, but didn't change behavior, either among farmers or among people in terms of their health care, in the ways that we expected. So then we said, well, let's try to go at this another way. So we went focused on agriculture, and we said, let's get one farmer in each community to be the champion of this good practice information. Load all that information on a phone. Give them a $90 smartphone that has an app. So you have an app that lets you do whatever on your phone. There was an app called Agricultural Information. And so he or she was charged with making sure everyone in that village applied the best information about how to get the most in terms of an environmentally sustainable way. And we saw two things. The third party studied it, and this study is online, you can look at it, by the International Food Policy Research Institute. And they said that two best practices that the government and agricultural extensionists have been pushing for years for farmers to take up, that they studied two groups of villages, one where there was a community knowledge worker empowered with this information tool, and a group where it weren't. And in where it wasn't, the adoption of this practice was basically unchanged. Within 2 years, the adoption of it in the CKW villages went up 31%, right? But the more interesting thing and more immediate benefit is one of the things on that app was you could get market prices. So if you just harvested something, cassava, and some kind of wholesaler came up to you and said, well, you should sell it for this. The price is here and it's going down. In the past, the farmers would have said, okay. Now they go onto they call their community knowledge worker and they say, well, you know what? Actually, in a market 10 miles from here, they're paying four times that. So the whole relationship, the exploitation. So I'll close with a story of a guy named Eric Obel. And Eric was a farmer in Uganda, and he harvested his crop in the past, I don't know, 2 years ago, I think this is, and basically got, because of being able to access those market prices, got five times more for his crops than he thought he would get, and than he'd gotten in previous years. Not 5% more, not 50% more, five times more. So he was so happy that he, using that information, was able to make a killing, really get what he deserved, that he informed our staff that he used the proceeds of that to buy a cow. He'd always had a vision. A lot of rural societies, owning cows is like a huge thing, a huge marker that you're on your way up. And then he named the cow Grameen, which has no meaning in any language in Uganda, but it had meaning for him, right? But ultimately, the power of this is that here was someone who, with that market price, knew what to do. And again, we were trying to enable people to leverage their own strengths and capabilities and desire to improve themselves, and give them a little tool, nothing major, information that existed on the internet, loans that we knew they'd pay back, almost 100% of them, give them that opportunity, and a lot of things change. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. Your message of the success of microfinancing to reduce poverty and the success of digital information to reduce exploitation is truly inspiring. Thank you for that. The speaker, Mr. Counts, has agreed to answer some questions from our audience. We will ask that you wait for the microphone so that our radio listeners will have the benefit of hearing your question. And before we do that, though, we do have a gift here for you. Alex, it's a book about Alaska, and we hope you'll come back to visit us again.
Also,
another plug for membership in the Alaska World Affairs Council. If you aren't a member and would like to join, I think their cards are on the table, and we'd certainly love to have you. And we hope you'll join us Wednesday, May 28th at the Petroleum Club when we start our Summer Ambassador Series with the British Ambassador. He'll be speaking on UK-Alaska relations and UK foreign policy priorities. If you could remember to RSVP us for these events, and if you need more information, you can always find it on our website or on our Facebook page. And one last housekeeping matter, if you'd help us by recycling your name tag so we have them for you the next time you come, we'd greatly appreciate that. And now for your questions.
So, just want to thank you for a very stimulating talk. By the way, that college age revelation over pizza and other beverages didn't happen to take place at the Nines, did it?
The Nines, yes.
Okay. Ithaca College. So, anyway, another phrase I've heard for microfinance is frugal entrepreneurship. And I think that actually kind of nicely summarizes what ultimately it's about here, is empowering people to do things. When you think about kind of the future of frugal entrepreneurship, microfinance, first of all, where does it need to establish itself or it hasn't already? And is there going to come a time that you foresee where there's going to be a need to kind of fill a gap between kind of frugal entrepreneurship and regular entrepreneurship?
So first of all, I did agree to take questions as long as Roger didn't get to ask any. Just the ground rules, I want it clear. So there are... two things. There are some white spaces in the geography of certain places, and even within India. Southern India has had enormous amount of microfinance, and unfortunately, in one state, some real backlash, and it got kind of ugly. But in the north of India, there are big places where microfinance still is not that accessible. If you look into say, Burma is a place, a lot of microlenders are going there now, but it's there hasn't been much, certainly a place like North Korea. And even in South America, it's all over the map. The Andean countries, Peru, Bolivia, some of those have done great. Brazil has had huge successes in poverty alleviation, but not really through a microfinance strategy. Mexico has lagged behind in most respects. And so there are, and that's one of the, I recently gave a speech where I talk about four waves of innovation in microfinance. And the third wave, is which still goes on to some extent, is around filling in those white spaces. There is a gap between, right, that the micro entrepreneur and the more kind of large enterprise. And one of the things that's happened in the last 10 years is that some micro lenders, as they've seen their most robust businesses need more and more capital, some of them have established alliances with banks. But they're a little not, you know, if you don't, unless you do that very carefully, I mean, what business would want to basically lose by design their best customers? So some of them have really tried to develop offerings for small and medium enterprises. Grameen Bank used to not give any loan larger than about $250, but they created offerings in the last 10 years that you could borrow up to $10,000 or $15,000. Rare, but there were people who could absorb that much. There are some micro lenders that try to do that, and including one that I've had a long association with in Haiti, that tried to serve that market segment and really realized that their skills in dealing with the micro market didn't transfer well. So some that have gotten out of it, some have tried to reinvent it and make another attempt at it. I think that at that level, meaning the whole trust factor, peer pressure, all the things that apply at the micro level, some of them don't work so well at the higher level. Or need to be reinvented. And this is where I think technology and information technology and credit scoring this kind of play in what we all hear about big data, but using it to develop correlations that can predict which businesses are likely to succeed. I think there's a big technology play to help microlenders serve that market, which has been a mixed record so far. But there have been some impressive successes. And what the one learning is that the people who make great microloans, the loan officers, they're not always the people that do the best small and medium enterprise. And so you need to have dedicated staff with kind of a different training. But I think that's one of the things we're going to be much farther along with in 5 years.
Thank you. I was wondering about the women of Afghanistan. Has your foundation invested in the poor women, or should I say politically correct, financially impaired, you know, of Afghanistan to help counteract the Taliban?
Well, yes and no, and let me say a few things about that. Grameen is a kind of a loose network of Grameen-branded organizations, and one of our sister organizations, Grameen Trust, if you believe this, was invited in to do microlending in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Maybe it was easier coming from another Muslim country. And they actually had some early successes, but the Taliban, who are not monolithic, not like, you know, no people are, could never make up their minds. So they would say, go and do it, and well, don't do it. And so finally, after 2 years of seeing that the women of Afghanistan really wanted that empowerment, Grameen Trust pulled out. And then a few years after that, the Taliban fell. A bunch of microlenders went in, we didn't. We've tended to avoid Grameen Foundation conflict zones for a variety of reasons. But one of the great microlenders of Bangladesh, BRAC, went in. An organization in Washington, D.C., FINCA, CHF International, went in. And that's been a mixed experience. BRAC ultimately, I've just learned, had to pull out of Afghanistan after they had some of their staff kidnapped and killed, and they had also issues with the government. Some of the others remain, but they've had some fraud cases things that have set them back. But ultimately in Afghanistan, and I've never been there, so I don't want to say I'm an expert on it, but microlending, where it's been able to go, and people have been able to work with a certain sense of security, the local people have just eaten it up. It's been very successful. But then between government, Taliban, And some of these issues, it's had a lot of hiccups, and still, you know, I think there are several hundred thousand microfinance borrowers there, but it could be a lot bigger if it wasn't such a kind of a difficult and insecure environment.
Hi. Sorry, that's really loud. Okay. I was just wondering how people qualified for loans. Like, was there a certain age that they could apply for one, certain genders that you were targeting, and one gender? Sorry.
Sure.
Yes, thank you.
Great question. Again, remember, it was apple juice. It was apple juice. So the idea is... in Bangladesh, which is the context I'm most familiar with, that basically you could borrow, after about 1984, all of the loans essentially were going to women. Men, the men's groups were there, they could continue, and if someone left, they could be replaced by a man, and I'll explain why in a second. Basically, anyone who is adult, which basically means, you know, late teens or older, could borrow. You needed to join a group of friends who would agree to help you through whatever tough times you had. Usually the number was five people. So if you couldn't find four other people in the village that would trust you and be willing to work with you, then maybe, you know, the bank was not so excited about lending to you if you, and they were supposed to be of similar kind of economic status. And you had to prove that you were under some poverty threshold. You couldn't be a kind of a middle class person who had other means of borrowing from a more of a traditional bank. But why women? Why were women prioritized? That's a really good question. So Professor Yunus, when he looked at the banks, and he was studying, he got his PhD at Vanderbilt, but when Bangladesh became independent in late 1971, he felt this call to go back and try to rebuild his country, and he started teaching economics. But teaching economics, these theories he'd learned in Tennessee, and seeing people dropping dead from starvation outside of his classroom, it just drove him nuts. And so he started seeing what could be done practically. And he said the banking system, he accused the banks of not lending to the people that were that actually had some skills. So right around that university, there are a lot of people with really great kind of artisan skills. And he said, the banks are terrible. They're anti-poor, they're anti-illiterate, and they're anti-women. And it doesn't have to be that way. So he said, once he started doing his own little kind of bank, he said, I'm going to have 50% of my, 50% of the borrowers be women, because it's 50% of the population. And it took him 6 years to reach that goal. That part of Bangladesh in that time was much more conservative than today. But when he reached it, he said, my gosh, this is a night and day. The women repay their loans much more regularly. They're right paying on the nose. The men might repay, fall behind, don't see them for a month, where are they? But even more important, and the researchers have backed this up in many studies, that the women would use the profits to either reinvest in the business or they would put it to the health, education, and nutrition of the family, of the children. The men would tend to spend the money on things like apple juice. So that became the norm globally, that people took that. Most regions, most organizations have said, forget it, we're providing financial services to the family, but we're gonna do it, and everyone in the family is often involved in the business, but we're going to do it through the woman. And that became an established best practice that is pretty common even today, 25 years later.
Hi, this has been a really good talk. I really enjoyed it. how do you classify people as poor? Because there's maybe different ranges of being poor.
No, that's a good question. And again, what would probably... If I were to take one of you into a Bangladesh village and bring you to a middle-class household in Bangladesh, and you walk into their house and you said, this is poorer than anything I've ever seen. So it's, you know, poverty is relative, But still, it's meaningful because so many social programs in every country that get designed for the poor, but if they're really attractive, people that are usually far above the poverty line end up getting most of the benefits. And that's just part of the human condition. People that are better educated are a little bit more clever. They're better networked. They can ask, you know, let me into that group. Let me into that program. I know I don't really qualify. And so Professor Yunus said, not going to happen in Grameen. So he designed something very simple, like everything he does. He tries to keep it, because simplicity is also transparency, right? So he said, in that village, if you want to borrow from Grameen, you have to meet two criteria. You cannot own more than a half an acre of farmland. And everyone knows how much land everyone has in Bangladesh, rural Bangladesh. And if you were to add up all of your assets, your house, your furniture, whatever, it can't be more than the value of 1 acre of medium quality land in that village. Very easy to determine. And so basically that became the cutoff point. Now what became interesting was, is if people joined the bank and they were met that, but then that through working their business, they got more, did they have to be kicked out? But Professor Yunus ultimately decided, because he ultimately allowed those women to buy shares in the bank and become the owners of it, how can the employees of an organization kick out the owners? So that was the policy there. Now, Grameen Foundation has a kind of applied that means of measuring poverty doing some very, based on some very advanced statistics, but that at the end of it is a very simple 10-question questionnaire or survey, because we don't only want to know whether people are under some poverty line through this quick survey that can be done in 10 minutes, but we want to track year by year, are people getting better or getting worse? And this is something called the Progress Out of Poverty Index. It's one of the things we're most proud of, applying that kind of Grameen commitment to accountability to everything that we do. And if you want to go online and check out Progress Out of Poverty Index, it's been developed for 56 countries around the world, home to 90% of the world's poor. It's a very exciting tool. But anyway, in the specific Bangladesh case, it's around a thumb rule that is, in a Bangladesh village context, everyone really knows, again, who's under that level and who's over it.
Thank you. I was sort of familiar when I grew up in Boston with a microloan program that resulted in, a loan at a kind of a high interest rate, and if you didn't pay, they'd break your arm. It's known as loan sharking, and of course, we got some regulation of that. So raises the question for me, what kind of interest rates are you charging? What enforcement policies do you have? Uh-huh. And the third type of question that goes with that is, what is your overhead, including the cost of solicitation for participation, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me make sure I get all those. So interestingly, tell a little story from history, pawn shops do not have really that good a reputation in today's terms. Now, I don't know if there are any pawn shop owners here. I don't want to, but pawn shops, I'm going to get, actually began in like 15th century Italy as something based on great idealism and values and ethics by some version of the Catholic Church. Someone here may know the history better than me. And yet sometimes things that come out of a real place of idealism and social change morph into things that aren't recognizable. And so let me speak to that in the context of microcredit. To take the example of Grameen, one of the largest microlenders in the world, basically it has, four different interest rates. So number one, the commercial loans, the loans for business, are made at 20%, 20% on a declining balance. And so when you account for inflation, basically it's less than a U.S. consumer pays on their credit card loans. They have a loan for housing, which is 8.5%. I'm sorry, 8%. Educational loan, a student loan for the children of borrowers at 5%. And then they have a certain loan program for destitute people, for beggars, which is interest-free. Right. So that's the gives you a sense of the range. Now, not all microlenders around the world have been able to be as efficient as Grameen and lend at those quite reasonable rates, in my mind. But the interest rates in microfinance have been declining about 3% per year globally as greater efficiency gains. The other thing I'll say about Grameen is Grameen also pays 8.5% on its deposits. And for some fixed deposits, pays as much as 11%. So just to give you a sense of the spread. In terms of efficiency, which is the basic way that it's measured, is how much does it cost you? So most microlenders, if they borrow from the market, like we did through our loan guarantees, mostly they have to borrow somewhere between 8% and sometimes even up to 16 to 17%. That's their just cost of capital. And then microlenders, the large and more efficient ones, have been able to lend that on to the borrowers at another maybe 8 to 10% interest cost, you know, unit cost in terms of the capital. And so that's, and there are examples of where the overhead costs beyond the financing costs has been gotten low as 5 or 6% in some parts of India where there have been a lot of efficiency gains. So that's, did I cover question? Okay.
Government regulation,
part of it. And in terms of, all I'd say is that governments are all over the map in terms of whether they've passed policies like the government of Morocco and Uganda and Peru that have really enabled microfinance sectors to flourish. And governments which have passed laws that have really stifled microfinance, and I could leave it at that for now. Yeah.
Last question.
Okay. My understanding is that in emerging markets like in Africa, because of the lower access to income, micro consumption is a much more popular way of consuming, like a couple of cents for a juice packet versus mm-hmm. buying a box of juice. Right. I was wondering if one. That was what had made institutions founded through microfinance by individuals more successful, and two, if that has been a barrier to entry for Western corporations and for FDI.
Mm. Well, so there was a great book by a guy who's passed away, unfortunately, C.K. Prahlad, and it was this whole thesis that there was a fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, right? That basically, if you could actually figure out how, you know, businesses, global businesses was kind of his main audience, could figure out how to serve the poor, the bottom of the economic pyramid, they could do very well. And then as the poor did better, they could do more business. But it was just for lack of the imagination of how do you serve. And one of the examples that they said had already gotten that right was around microfinancing, that they had kind of re-engineered banking so that it could actually interface with. But he, you know, they said little things like in a lot of countries where they were trying to bring detergent to wash clothes, that the poor weren't buying it. But the truth of the matter is that you could only buy it in these large amounts, containers, that the poor couldn't afford. But if you broke it down into, and in fact, many retailers, they would buy the large, just what we would consider like a family size thing of detergent, and they would just put in these little baggies. That you could buy for a fraction of it, and then people would buy it because they didn't want to buy enough detergent for 2 months. They didn't have that much disposable cash, but they would buy it for their next couple of times that they were going to, you know, wash their clothes. So that's really the challenge, and that's where I think both technology, but also just human imagination and intuition, reinventing retail, reinventing energy, reinventing financial services, information technology, computers, agriculture, healthcare, around the actual needs and constraints and underappreciated capacity of the poor. That's the challenge that C.K. Prahlad threw out to us. And I think that because we're beginning to respond, again, in the financial services space, maybe a little bit further ahead, we're going to be able to see a lot of a lot of progress in the next 5 to 10 to 15 years, and perhaps meet the challenge that Jim Kim has set out. And Jim Kim, the president of the World Bank, who I first saw at a results banquet, 10 years ago, and now he's appointed to that role, where he said, we want to virtually eliminate abject poverty by 2030, under 3% of the global population. And again, it's not basically that we need more resources, right? Like my board member said, the resources are already there. It's about delivery channels and products and services that, just like Goldman Sachs has products and services designed around the unique needs of the super wealthy, you can also design products around the needs of the poor. And if you do that, resources start reorienting themselves and you can make progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you once again for sharing your time and knowledge with us. Mr. Counts, and thank you to Results for the partnership in bringing Mr. Counts to us so we could all hear him here today. And we hope you all will join us for our Summer Ambassador Series beginning at the end of this month. Thank you for coming.